But that was really the beginning point of the nation of Israel from leaving the land where they were held in bondage to be an independent nation. Now, for the next 40 years, they were wandering in the wilderness because of their own provocations of the Lord. But so there was a 40-year period from the Exodus to when they actually conquered the land of Canaan, entered the land of Canaan and conquered it, where God delivered that land per those promises he'd made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So now you had a nation with number and with a dwelling place, a land of their own. And that was the beginning of the nation of Israel. So he had them to begin their calendar and the new year from the Exodus, from when he passed over the Passover, when he passed over the houses of the Israelites and killed all the firstborn in Egypt of man and beast. And that's what led to Pharaoh saying, go. And they spoiled the Egyptians and left. But that was when God, he had them as a new nation beginning their calendar that first month. So that's how they started out. So that's where Joshua comes in. And from that point, so that's covering Israel from its beginning point. At that time, what was their government, form of government that the nation had? It was under judges. That's correct. And so for the first 450 years there when they were in Canaan, they were under the rule of judges. Well, did they vote on that? Was that by democracy, as we call it? Is that did they have elections running for? Did they compete for running for the office of judge over Israel? No, there was no campaigning. There was no election for that. How was it decided who would be the judge to be their leader? Well, who was the first judge? Moses. Who was the second? Joshua. Well, who chose Moses? God did. Who chose Joshua? God did. Who chose all the judges from thereafter, all the ones he ever had? That was a choice by God. So you had God choosing the very best of the entire nation to be their leaders. Does that sound like a bad system? I mean, yes, purely spiritual qualifications, their righteousness and pleasing of the Lord. And the ones that and God would choose the one with the very best heart to be and to be the leader for the nation. I mean, how could you do better than that? But what did they end up eventually doing? Get to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and they're, we want a king like all the nations. They wanted a king. They wanted to be like everybody else. Well, that's exactly what they did. They became like everybody else. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? What made them special? What made them distinct, unlike everybody else? They were God's people. They'd been given a law by God unlike anybody else had. They had leaders chosen by God himself unlike anybody else had. They were distinct, and they were very different from any other people on earth because of those blessings from God. But they said, nah, we want to be like all the other nations, which is exactly what they became. And even worse. So they became, instead of being people holy to the Lord, they became very wicked under kings. They had, starting with Saul, after 450 years of judges, God said, okay, you demand a king, you'll have a king. Here's what your king will be like. Well, we want a king. And they got what they asked for, with all that went along with it. How does a king, who determines who the next king is if you have a monarchy? The heir, yeah. So the king dies and his son becomes king. I mean, it can get complicated if you have some problems with the if something happens to that son. That's why the age old goal is to have at least would be for a king to have two sons, the heir and the spare. Sometimes that didn't work either. Remember Henry VIII? But anyway, but that's the basic design. And so with a king, one dies and then his son becomes the next king. Well, what if he's wicked? If he's the heir, then who becomes king? You get a wicked king. Did that ever happen in Israel? The majority of the time. And you may recall from Saul, you had Saul, David, and Solomon, three kings over the entire nation, reigning over 12 tribes, all 12 tribes of Israel. But after Solomon's death, God split the kingdom, and he gave the tribe of Benjamin with Judah being David and Solomon's tribe. Solomon's son, Rehoboam, became king over the tribe of Judah, his tribe, with Benjamin. The other 10 tribes were given to Rehoboam, and they became a separate kingdom. And so you had a kingdom in the north with 10 tribes, and then you had the other two being the southern kingdom of Judah, as it was called. And so for the rest of the period of the kings, that's the way it was. It was divided. Well, each of those two kingdoms had 19 kings. So you had the first three, Saul, David, Solomon, and then you had 19 kings of Judah, 19 kings of the northern kingdom of Israel with those 10 tribes. But keep in mind, the 19 kings in the north, that was over a shorter period of time, because from their beginning with under Jeroboam, Jeroboam was afraid for his kingdom and its security. Because by God's law, three times in the year for the three feast days, the Passover, the Feast of Weeks or Pentecost, and then the Feast of Tabernacles later in the year, they had those three feast days. Three times in the year, all the males were commanded by the law of Moses to present themselves in Jerusalem to the Lord. So that meant three times a year, all the Israelites would go to Jerusalem, which was the capital city, of course, of the kings from David and Solomon, and then all of his successors, including Rehoboam. So here's Jeroboam, who becomes a new king of his own kingdom, and all of his subjects are going to the capital city of the rival kingdom three times a year. And so he's thinking, this is going to go bad for me. Because if they keep going down there, they're going to follow Rehoboam, the king that dwells there, and then I'll lose my life and kingdom. Well, of course, that should not have been a worry to him, because God gave him a promise if he followed the Lord with all of his heart that God would make his kingdom sure. So with that promise, he had nothing to worry about. So that was he created that worry and problem on his own when he had none. Do people ever create problems for themselves when there's not one actually? I mean, there's just, we've probably all done it, but hopefully not to the extent that Jeroboam did. Few have done it to that level, but I mean, Jeroboam. So that was, from that moment on, then he created a new religion for his kingdom, forbidding them from going to Judah, made up two golden calves, and he put one in at each end of the kingdom, one in Dan, one in Bethel, made up his own priests, his own feast days, and an entirely new religion for his kingdom, a denomination. And that, of course, led the people away from God. And all of the 19, from Jeroboam through Hosea, the 19th and final king of that kingdom, They were astray from the Lord all those years, and God brought them to an end at the hand of the Assyrians. That was in 722 BC. So that would have been, 136 years before the end of the southern kingdom. So you had 19 kings in the north But that was in 136 fewer years than the southern kingdom got. So they were changing kings much more rapidly, and that had to do with the wickedness of the kingdom, because there was a lot of murder. A king would get murdered by somebody who would take over the kingdom, and then somebody would murder him. So there was a lot of bloodshed. All of the kings in Judah were descendants of David, as God promised them. And but they turned away from the Lord too. Out of all of those kings, 19 in the northern kingdom, 19 in the southern kingdom, and add in Saul, David, and Solomon, that gives you 41 total kings that ever ruled through the whole period of the kings. Out of those 41, you remember how many were righteous? Six. That was David, his son Solomon, and then four of the kings of the 19 of Judah. None of the ones in Israel, but six out of 41. Now, what percentage of the judges were righteous? 100%. What percentage of all the kings were righteous? Six out of 41. So, what, that's like 14? Yeah, a little bit more, just a little more than 10%. Is that a difference? It is. And then, how did Judah come to an end then? The northern kingdom of Israel came to a complete end at the hands of the Assyrians. They conquered them, took a remnant away, and scattered them among various nations that they had conquered, and they disappeared from history, those 10 tribes. And so you had the southern kingdom left for the next 136 years, and then in 586 BC, what happened to the kingdom of Judah? It was conquered by Babylon. And Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was destroyed. God preserved a remnant in captivity in Babylon. And how long were they in Babylon in captivity, that remnant that was left? 70 years. So you had the 70-year period of exile, of captivity in Babylon. So that's the end of the kings. So you had judges, then you had kings, and then you have that 70-year period in exile. Then you have what happened after the Babylonian captivity. After those 70 years, the Lord brought back that remnant. Well, the ones that chose to go back under Zerubbabel, who was a descendant of those kings of Judah and was one of the physical heirs or ancestors of Christ in that royal line, because Christ was the heir to the throne of David. He was the rightful heir to that throne by birth. Of course, he inherited that throne and sits on that throne as a, not a physical, but a spiritual throne, reigning over his spiritual kingdom, his church, to this day and will forevermore. He is the eternal king, the Christ. So he descended through that royal line, but we saw there were about 50,000 people that followed Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest in going back to Israel after the 70-year captivity in Babylon. And that was all that was there from all of those people that were the children of Israel. That's all that was left and that came back to Israel at that time. Some others came later. But the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are focused on those captives that had returned over the next couple of generations. So we were looking at that period of time that would carry us all the way. By the time you get to the end of the book of Nehemiah, it brings you to what is the end of the period covered by the Old Testament books. There is a period of Israel's history that is between the Testaments, between the end of the Old Testament, that period of history that goes through Nehemiah, and is also brings us into the time period of the prophet Malachi, which is the end of the Old Testament books. Then you have about 400 years that is after that, before the beginning of the New Testament and the history that is picked up there. So there's a 400-year gap as far as the scriptures covering the events as they went along. And that's referred to as the period between the Testaments, which obviously we don't have scripture about that directly. So we do have some historical records of things that went on during that time, but outside of the Bible. But as far as the actual Bible record, there is nothing from that point on. So we reach, with Nehemiah, we reach really the end of what is the historical record of God's people in Israel. All right, so that leaves one little piece of the puzzle that's not covered, that we will see covered at least somewhat in this book of Esther. What is that piece? Well, what's going on with, because what did we find out with when Zerubbabel went and led the people back on when Cyrus made his, King Cyrus of Persia, Cyrus the Great, made his proclamation for all the children of Israel to go back, and they rebuilt the temple, but about 50,000 went. A lot didn't. What happened to them? So we do get a glimpse of that. There were a lot of Jews that had settled in various places in the Babylonian Empire under its captivity, and then when they were taken over by the Persians at the time when Cyrus decreed that all the children of Israel could go back, many of them settled in places in the now the Persian Empire, and they remained there. So there were Jews that were in far-flung places throughout the Persian Empire, which was a vast empire. The territory of the Persian Empire, what did it include? Well, it included all of the what we know of as the Middle East, what nation today would be identified with the home region region of Persia? In fact, the people from that nation consider themselves Persians. They refer to themselves as that. I mean, so do you know what nation that is? That's Iran. So if you think of Persia, I mean, like just as far as that home territory, Iran would be the home region, what is present-day Iran for. But they covered a lot more. Their empire covered a lot more than just that area. I mean, everything in the Middle East, all the way to the east, including much of India, present day India. It was a vast, vast empire. Well, there were Jews that settled all through those provinces and areas of the Persian Empire over those years. During the time of the Greeks, they persisted there, and that all the way into the time of the Roman Empire, by the time that we get to the New Testament. When the gospel was being spread in the first century AD, the gospel of Christ, when Paul and the other missionaries would go to cities, wherever they went, where did they always go first? The pattern was you'd see they'd go first to a synagogue. Well, where do we ever read about Paul arriving someplace and there's no synagogue, there are no Jews there? They were everywhere. I mean, and there were synagogues. All the major cities, they had a community in those places. Well, when did that begin? I mean, that goes all the way back to the captivity in Babylon and then under Persia, where the ones that didn't go back to Israel, they settled those areas and spread around through all that territory, and that pattern persisted all the way into the time of the when the New Testament, when we're reading about it there, we see the many years later, those communities are still in existence. That's right. Yeah, that's true, because under the Greeks, I mean, with Alexander, I mean, he conquered Egypt, so his empire covered into Africa. And so you, so that spread continued through the subsequent empires and the territories that they conquered, and particularly under the Greeks. So that spreading continued, but its birth or beginning of that was in the Babylonian captivity, and that just continued on through the centuries and under the great empires that followed from Babylon all the way through Persia, Greece, and Rome. That's where the system of having synagogues began. Before the Babylonian captivity, where did the Jews live? Well, in Israel. Where else did they live? Well, there really weren't anywhere else. So where did they go three times a year per God's law? They would all go to Jerusalem. Well, they would continue to journey from far places. That's why in the book of Acts in chapter 2, we get to we're reading the day of Pentecost, and it describes the different areas where these Jews had traveled from for that feast. That's quite a list. And if you look at the territories, they traveled a long way to get there. But where they lived when they practiced their religion in all these places that were far from Israel, they started that system where they had a local congregations of Jews in these places, and they had their meeting place, which were the synagogues. And so that became the seeds, really, for where the gospel was spread in the time of Christ. So it's interesting to see this Old Testament history and actually how it ties into later and facilitates the spread of Christ's gospel throughout the world because of the presence of Jews in all these different places. When we read the book of Esther, we're going to be reading about some Jews that this is under the Persian Empire, and this is actually quite a few years. Who was the first Persian emperor, the one that we read about made the decree by God's prophecy, including going back to Isaiah chapter 44, where he was called by name 100 years ahead of time through the mouth of Isaiah the prophet, that he would send the children of Israel back to their land to rebuild the temple. Who was that? I've already mentioned him, but who was that one? And he has the great attached to his name from Cyrus, yes. And so Cyrus was that first, he's the one that conquered Babylon. So he's the first of the true Persian emperors that we would recognize. Cyrus conquered Babylon in 539 BC. That's also when he made his decree for the Israelites to return to Israel. So that's 539 BC. And that's when the first captives go back and they lay the foundation of the temple shortly after their return there. Well, the work on the temple stopped, as we know. And that was all recorded in the book of Ezra until the Persian ruler Darius the Great found the records of Cyrus and what he decreed and decreed that decree be followed, which is, of course, what the Persian law. They had a law that they couldn't change their laws. So once a decree was made by a ruler, then that was enforced permanently. And so they kept meticulous records. And so when they searched all that and Darius found that record, he said, okay, that's the way it is. He's the one that the construction on the temple had been held up for a good period of time by the opposition of the those Samaritan people that were the enemies of the Jews. They didn't want them back in Israel, and they did not want them rebuilding the temple. But that was resumed and completed, that really goes all the way to 486 BC to the end of the reign of Darius or Darius, however you want to say it, the Great. So Cyrus began his reign in 539, and reign of Darius or Darius was from 521 to 486 BC. Well, then after in 486 BC, the next Persian ruler was Xerxes. And he's the one that we're going to read about here in the book of Esther that is referred to by a title name, I've got tongue-tied on it here. How come I've just gotten in my own way here? I've said this a million times. Ahasuerus, okay? So this is Xerxes. So this is the one from history known as King Xerxes, one of the one of the most well-known Persian kings in history. He fought the Greeks. he did a lot of things to expand the Persian Empire. So he was one of their mightiest rulers. So this would put this time period now, what we're reading about in the book of Esther, after Xerxes' accession to the throne of Persia in 486 BC. So this would cover somewhere between 486 to 476 BC. So that gives us a time frame as far as knowing when this what period of time is covered in the book of Esther. So somewhere in Xerxes' reign from 486 to 476 BC. So this is into the 5th century BC. This is really at the end point in this time frame where, as far as what the Old Testament books cover in this time frame, this is about to the end of it. The book of Esther begins in verse 1 saying, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces." So, we can read, how vast is that? From Ethiopia to India. That's a big territory. That is an enormous territory, and it was divided up into 127 provinces. So this is a vast empire that Xerxes is ruling over. And he is... as far as the earth was concerned in his time, was there a mightier man on earth during these years than Ahasuerus, which is King Xerxes? There's nobody to compare to him on earth in this time. So the first verse of the book of Esther lets us know the vast territory that he reigned over. We know the book of Esther was written after Xerxes' time. He doesn't identify whom he inspired with the words to record these things that happened here in the book of Esther. So if somebody's wanting to know, well, who is the divinely inspired writer of the book of Esther, that is not identified. That person is not identified. We know it was written after the events were over, obviously, but also after the reign of Ahasuerus or Xerxes. It tells us in chapter 10 and verse 2 of this book about the acts of Ahasuerus. It says they were written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. That's the record of King Xerxes. It was already written in those chronicles. So was he still around, or was that after his time? So it was sometime after, which is what we would expect, because these events in this book are about his what is going on in his reign. So after his reign is over, somewhere after that, God inspired someone to, a prophet, to record these words, with these words, to record what happened in the time of Esther, and for us to know about these events here in this book. So we'd mentioned that Nehemiah was written somewhere after 444 B.C., and so this Esther and Nehemiah were written, were inspired, the writings came very close to around the same time in the mid-5th century B.C. So this is really at the end, as we then begin the Between the Testaments period. But this is giving us, instead of giving us the view that Nehemiah did of what was going on in Israel during this time, we're seeing some what's going on as far as it pertains to the Jews throughout the kingdom of Persia at this very time. Now it's going to concentrate on what happened with Esther herself, but it's going to pertain to, and as far as the impact it was going to have on all the Jews throughout the world, so throughout the Persian Empire, wherever they were in these 127 provinces, from Ethiopia to India, because there were Jews scattered all over the place. And there is this very wicked man named Haman who ends up in a position of power where by his jealousy of Esther's family member Mordecai, who is a Jew, Haman is going to hate the Jews and bring about an order for their entire annihilation. Hitler wasn't the first person to have that idea, so Haman was had the same plan, but he was going to have them wiped out off the earth through all of this entire territory where they lived. All the Jews were to be killed. That was his order because of his hatred of Mordecai. So God's going to use Esther and have the queen of Persia to be a Jew, a Jewess, and is going to use her to save the Jews from that. So this is going to pertain to events that are going to pertain to the Jews that existed throughout the world during this time. So Lord willing, next opportunity we have, we'll delve into this some more. So we've had a little a review of Old Testament history, and also specifically as this time frame of the book of Esther, and where we are in historical times, Persian Empire, and what's going to happen as it pertains to God's people during that time period throughout the world. All right, we're out of time, so we want to go to our Heavenly Father in prayer here as we close.